Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org. Hi, I'm Jen White, and this is the 1A Podcast. It's time for the news roundup. It was promised yesterday.
We have reached agreement to extend the debt ceiling through early December, and it's our hope that we can get this done as soon as today.
After a late night, Congress has once again kicked the can down the road, specifically to early December. All 50 Senate Democrats voted to extend the debt limit and avoid default, at least for now. The decision tees up another big fight in December, one that will collide with efforts to avoid a government shutdown. Let's get into it with Anita Kumar, the senior editor of Standards and Ethics at Politico. Anita, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Also with us, Jonathan Lemire, AP's White House reporter and a political analyst with MSNBC. Jonathan, always great to have you on.
Hey there. Always great to be here.
So let's start with last night. Democrats managed to peel off some Republicans as Minority Leader Mitch McConnell stepped back from a standoff. Anita, what happened?
Well, you are so right. They kicked the can down the road. Basically, this is a short-term fix. The Congress voted for they're going to extend, raise the debt ceiling, and they'll have to deal with this in December. But really what has been happening this week is that both parties, the Democrats and Republicans, said, you know, we're not going to do what the other party wants, right? They just couldn't decide how to get to this point. And what we saw was the Senate Minority Leader, Mitch McConnell, finally just sort of said, look, we'll agree to help do this. And of course, he criticized Democrats, saying this was a Democratic created disaster, crisis created by the Democratic Party. But he did propose this short-term fix, which averts this problem until December, when they're going to have to fund the government again and also raise the debt ceiling.
Jonathan, what do we know about the 11 Republicans who were swayed?
We know that some of them were met with disapproval from others in their party. It was rather stunning last night to have Republican senators like Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham openly criticize Leader McConnell, someone with whom they usually don't break ranks, accusing him of surrendering and that the Democrats were about to blink in this game of chicken. And I think we should not gloss over this idea that if this deal was not reached and the government were to default, leading economics and the White House say that it would trigger a catastrophic global recession, one likely worse than 2008, because so much of the world is still battling the pandemic. It would have impacted the lives of every American, as well as American businesses. And it's usually this debt ceiling is lifted in an apolitical exercise, not always, but usually. And certainly there were bad faith arguments being made by Republicans here, suggesting that this was about future Democratic spending, linking it to President Biden's agenda, when really this is about paying the debts of things that have already been purchased, money that has been spent, including under Republican President Trump. So this was suddenly turned into a very dangerous game of political chicken. Yes, McConnell seems to have been the one to blink, but we're going to be playing this again in a couple of months, and there's no sense that the Republicans are going to be any more willing to cooperate then, while Democrats refuse to lift it as part of their reconciliation package. So we're going to be playing this dangerous game again with real-world consequences.
Well, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned not just about defaulting on the debt, but this constant brinksmanship, that this instability and uncertainty also has an impact on our economy. Jonathan, talk about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That this would be, people's 401ks would be impacted, that it would be difficult for places to offer loans, that the U.S. is, of course, the dollar is sort of the standard currency for the globe. It would be impacted. It would be ramifications both short and long term. And the White House published a report earlier this week by some of their top economic advisors saying that if this were to happen, the U.S. government wasn't sure how they'd be able to sort of put the toothpaste back in the tube, that they wouldn't be an easy fix, if the nation were to default. So it is something that we're certainly grateful that it was avoided. But there were some real dark, scary terms here being tossed around. And we certainly heard the White House really lobby Republicans to try to get this done. We heard from the president. He gathered a number of CEOs. I was there at the White House this week when he did that, and they were testifying as to why this would be so disastrous if it were to happen. And again, we see right now a nation's economy that is recovering, but slowly and not in a straight line. It's really been a haphazard recovery from the pandemic. The jobs report number just out a short time ago, disappointing, and this would have been devastating.
So Congress has pushed this decision to December 3rd. It's also pushed the decision about funding the government to December 3rd. Yesterday, I spoke to Senator Tim Kaine, the Democrat from Virginia, and he says he believes that pushing these decisions closer to the holidays creates more of a sense of urgency because lawmakers want to get home to their families. Anita, is that realistic?
I mean, it's what we've always seen. Sometimes Congress acts, or not sometimes, lately, Congress tends to act when they are getting ready to go for recess or they are getting ready for a holiday. They are going to want to leave town, and I think that putting this near the holidays makes it even more likely that there's going to be this real sense of urgency. So does that get them to the point that they'll actually do something? Of course, we don't know. It seems to have gotten, you know, every year we kind of are faced with some of these things, and every year we say, look, they wait till the very last minute. So are they going to wait till the last minute and get it done, or are they not? You know, obviously we've seen shutdowns before. We've seen them stay in town and deal with these issues. It's just going to create more of a problem in December. And of course, they're also facing these other sort of self-imposed deadlines that they had to pass these huge spending bills, which I know we'll talk about. So they've got a lot on their plate. And of course, as you know, the closer we get to the 2022 elections, the midterm elections next year, which seem far away, but they're really not, you know, the more political gamesmanship there is, right? They're talking about what are going to be in their ads and mailers and what voters might look at, who might voters blame for something to go wrong or for not getting something done. So the further this goes on, the more likely those elections are going to be a part of this.
Jonathan, as Anita alluded to, Democrats have imposed this deadline to reach a deal on infrastructure by the end of the month. Again, it is self-imposed. Will that happen?
Well, it slipped once before, so it can certainly slip again. One thing is, though, that this now that this debt ceiling matter has been kicked to December, Democrats have been telling me this now gives them a two and a half month window here to get this two-piece Biden agenda through. We know, of course, the bipartisan infrastructure deal has already, you know, been voted upon and through the Senate, but that needs to go through the House. And then, of course, there's this Democrats-only reconciliation package, and there's been a lot of back and forth. There are real divides within the Democratic caucus as to the shape and size of that package. Of course, most of the attention focused on Senators Manchin of West Virginia and Sinema of Arizona, who want a much smaller number than other Democrats and have at times been very cagey as to what they are looking for. But then they're not alone. There are certainly some House moderates who have complained rather vociferously and loudly on the record, saying they want to get this package done. They want more leadership from President Biden to see it through. And of course, there are progressives who are trying to hold the line so to have as big a number as possible. So the White House has shifted tactics to try to push this across the finish line, that after a few weeks where the president was largely in Washington, he sort of hit the road. I was with him in Michigan on Tuesday when he toured a union training center and gave an impassioned pitch for his bill and sort of really laid out what was in it. And that's as a final point, I think that's important. And when those advisors in the White House I've talked to acknowledge something they weren't very good at. There was so much focus on the top line, how much it was going to cost. People sort of lost sight as to what was in the bill. And that was the president's goal for that event in Michigan. And we expect others in the days and weeks ahead to really remind Americans and therefore lawmakers, hey, what's in the bill here, family leave, childcare, things like that, these are really popular things. They pull really well, hoping to add pressure to get this done.
So, Jonathan, what will you be watching between now and the end of the month as Democrats push to get these infrastructure bills through, but also until December when we'll have to make these decisions on the debt ceiling and funding the government?
Well, I'm first of all watching our colleagues on Capitol Hill probably not get much sleep. There's so much on the agenda here. I mean, I think that it's going to be the greatest test of House Speaker Pelosi to keep the two very different sides of her caucus together to get this done. There's the two senators, of course. And I think we should look for President Biden to take a far more active role in getting this done to try to seal the deal. presidency and potentially the party's future in the midterms are at stake.
We'll be back with more of the news roundup in just a moment. Remember to have your questions answered on future topics or to just let us know what you think. Tweet us at 1A. We'll be back with more after the break.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Wyzant, a one-to-one tutoring alternative to online classes where you can learn face-to-face online. Get help with tackling new subjects and career skills, or just catching up. Wyzant lists thousands of personal instructors in over 300 subjects, available for live, individualized lessons with their online learning platform. Head to wyzant.com to find your perfect instructor. Love it, or your first hour is free. Because at Wyzant, we take learning personally.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Now let's get back to discussing some of the week's biggest stories. While Facebook is once again under fire, on Tuesday, whistleblower Frances Haugen offered scathing testimony to Congress about her former employer.
I'm here today because I believe Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg had a very different opinion about the company's operations. In a blog post published on Tuesday, Zuckerberg said, quote, "This idea that we prioritize profit over safety and well-being, that's just not true," end quote. Anita, tell us more about Frances Haugen and what she's accusing Facebook of doing.
She is a former employee at Facebook, and what you'll hear Facebook, the company, say is that, look, she didn't even work there that long. So she had worked there for a couple years. She left and she decided that she wanted to talk about and show the world sort of what Facebook was about, or what she's alleging it's about. And she has released thousands and thousands of pages of documents that she says backs up her claims. So what she's saying is that the company knows that it spreads misinformation and that it harms children, but it won't make the changes that it needs to make because it can hurt its profits. She says that Facebook is designed to exploit negative emotions, which has people on the site longer and allows it to make money. And she also said that it prematurely turned off the safeguards that it had put into place about misinformation after the election last year, and that it sort of contributed to what happened on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol. So all of these things were very powerful. Of course, Facebook, as you said, pushed back and said, look, she wasn't there that long. She didn't deal with a lot of the things that she's talking about. She didn't have firsthand knowledge. And they are basically saying that these things are just not true.
Now, Jonathan, this isn't the first time Facebook has been criticized for their operations, and the reputation's been steadily crumbling. Just last year, the platform reported a decline of 2 million daily users in the U.S. and Canada. But are these claims particularly damaging?
Well, they've probably never had a run of bad PR like this. The new cover of Time magazine has a picture of Mark Zuckerberg on it with an icon saying delete over it with an arrow, a cursor about to click it. And the certainly tremendous reporting by the Wall Street Journal in recent weeks about the influence of Facebook, which of course owns Instagram, and the fact that they very well knew in their own analysis, their own reports, internal reviews, that their products were damaging the self-esteem of young women and girls and potentially even driving some of them to consider suicide. But you're right. Certainly we've heard Facebook is the center of a lot of the misinformation that we faced in a couple of different elections, 2016 in particular. Now, the spreading vaccine conspiracy theories and those about COVID. The question is, will Congress actually do anything about it? They're demanding. One thing they're considering is demanding Facebook's algorithm so they can get a look at how these content is promoted to certain users. But that's like Facebook's secret sauce, and they're going to fight that tooth and nail to give that up.
Well, this week, as you said, has renewed calls for greater internet regulation, even from Facebook itself. I'm in response to Frances Haugen's testimony. Facebook's Director of Policy Communications, Lena Peach, said, quote, "We agree on one thing. It's time to begin to create standard rules for the internet," end quote. Anita, why has it been difficult for Congress to act when it comes to creating new internet regulations?
Oh, it's difficult for Congress to do everything, isn't it? You know, they've been hearing, we've had seen some very high-profile hearings in the past. Obviously, maybe not as much as this one, but definitely we've been hearing things. They just haven't been able to agree. But actually, what we heard this week is, look, we're not as far apart as we think. And this is Democrats and Republicans saying there are some things we can agree to. One of the problems, I think, is that there's the question of what to do, right? And I think what we heard from this whistleblower was sort of interesting. It wasn't that, oh, Facebook needs to just close up. It doesn't need to break apart. There are some things that could be done. I'm not saying that they're modest, but more modest than, you know, sort of closing down Facebook, that could make a difference. So she was talking about, you know, adding another click before users can easily share content. So making it harder to share that content, to making changes on how people see things so that it's chronological and as opposed to what it is now, sort of looking at what you look at and seeing which things would be more relevant to you, right? There are things that can be done that maybe aren't the biggest things in the whole world, but that maybe Democrats and Republicans could possibly agree to.
Well, Jonathan, I want to point back to that statement from Facebook's Director of Policy Communications, because the company has been calling for updated internet regulations for a while now. But at the same time, you said they're pushing back against calls to get a better understanding of how their algorithm works. Where is the conflict?
Well, I think it's the intersection of good policy and profit that Facebook is still, even if its numbers have slipped some, is an absolute behemoth. It is one of the bigger tech companies out there and still makes an extraordinary amount of money, and they're reluctant to do things to give that up. The sense of it from those on the Hill that I've talked to and those in the industry, or that what Facebook's trying to do here, is kind of meet them halfway. Like, look, yes, hey, we want to make a good faith effort to make things better, have more regulation, have a little more uniformity, perhaps, not just for them, but other tech companies too, as to what and how these sites, which are so pervasive, which are part of everyone's daily life, how they can be better regulated and moderated, thinking that they're better voluntarily go halfway than have this all enforced upon them. And this is a moment where there's been rare partisan agreement that there are some Republicans and some Democrats alike who think that, for very different reasons, mind you, think that the big tech needs to be better moderated. But there's not an agreement yet as to exactly how and how sweeping that would be.
Now, if you wanted to see the world without Facebook, you got a chance to on Monday. Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp were down for 5 hours following an outage. And while the platforms were down, Telegram, an instant messaging app, registered 70 million new users, according to the app's founder. Anita, do we know what caused the outage?
I think there were a lot of people that right away were saying it must have been a hack or something like that. But Facebook actually said that it was its own problems, that it was something went wrong with Facebook's routers that coordinate sort of network traffic, and then that set about a lot of disruptions to all of its systems, and that they were, to make matters worse, that the solution to this, they needed their own internal systems to work, and that also failed. So sounds like it was a confluence of events that prompted this. It was not, they are saying that it wasn't anything that was a hack or external. It was just one of those things that happens. But it was one of their worst problems since they had we don't remember because this was before the pandemic, but it was from 2019 that they were offline for nearly 24 hours.
Well, let's move away from tech and look at some political news. On Wednesday, a federal judge blocked the Texas 6-week abortion ban known as SB8. And the decision came in response to a lawsuit filed by the Justice Department. Jonathan, remind us of the details of this case.
So this is the sweeping new restrictions on abortion in Texas, which more or less eliminates the ability to have a legal abortion in that state, one that Republicans in the state of Texas, which of course is the second biggest in the country, have wanted for a while. Other states with Republican-controlled state governments have been eyeing it as well, basically making it impossible to have an abortion after 6 weeks. And that's a moment where a lot of women don't even know they're pregnant. This, when it first came down, it was met with a lot of anger and concern from Democrats, but also just those pro-choice, those with believe in women's health issues. And the Supreme Court basically took a pass on weighing in, which allowed it to stand. Now we have had this judge nullified, at least for now, but the state of Texas filed an appeal within an hour. So certainly the legal fight on this, it will continue. And it has returned abortion to the center of American politics in a way it hasn't been in a while, as these other states are eyeing their own regulations, and cases will be come before the Supreme Court in what will be a very eventful term in the months ahead, which more or less may revisit Roe v. Wade in a sense. So yes, this is a significant move, and it's a precursor. So it's just another step on what I think is going to be a very tough fight on abortion heading into the midterms.
And you're referring there to a case the Supreme Court will be hearing on abortion out of Mississippi. Anita, practically speaking, what does this mean for Texas and abortion access in the meantime?
Yeah, it's a great, great question. And we actually don't fully know that, because what we have seen out of Texas from abortion providers, or those that used to provide abortions, is that they could still face the consequences. Say they go back into business and they are providing those services, and another judge or another court reverses this, and they could face the consequences for those procedures they had in the meantime. So there are a lot of clinics and providers that are reluctant to resume their full activities until they know sort of what this is going to look like. Because this could go back and forth for quite some time, and we just don't know how it's going to play out. And so there's some hesitation there by some of those providers that I've seen in Texas as to what to do. We don't really know, and I don't think we're going to have any sort of stability in this area until really probably, this goes all the way up maybe to the Supreme Court, or if this case doesn't go there, then of course the case you just mentioned is going to be heard in a couple months. We might not get the results of that until, or the court might not have an order until next year sometime.
Attorney General Merrick Garland has ordered the FBI to address what he calls a, quote, disturbing spike in harassment, intimidation, and threats of violence against educators and school board members. Jonathan, in a memorandum this week, Garland cited highly politicized issues like COVID-19 mask mandates, a teaching about race and racism. Give us more context. What are we seeing around the country right now?
We've seen a sharp uptick in moments of harassment towards educators, teachers in particular, but also principals, superintendents, school staffers, and exactly for what you said as part of this pandemic about school districts that try to require masks for all students, school districts that have suggested there should be vaccine mandates for employees. And certainly we've had a lot of irate parents, particularly on the issue of masks, of having their children have to wear a mask. And there have been ugly scenes from, I saw some news clips just today in the last few days from Tennessee, from Missouri, from Alabama, states where there are heated confrontations in school board meetings, Virginia is another, or outside in the parking lot where parents are going up to teachers and saying, we know where you live, we can find you. Really sort of scary stuff and harassing of educators who are doing, of course, no more important work. Again, there's nothing more important work than teaching our young children. So this is an effort to try to protect that, to try to protect those teachers, to ramp up prosecutions and protection of them who are now suddenly, in an unlikely way, the second year of this pandemic are very much in harm's way.
Well, at a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, Republican Senator Josh Hawley from Missouri questioned the intent of the memo. Here he is addressing Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco.
I think parents across this country are going to be stunned to learn, stunned, that if they show up at a local school board meeting, by the way, where they have the right to appear and be heard, where they have the right to say something about their children's education, where they have the right to vote, and you are attempting to intimidate them. You are attempting to silence them. You are attempting to interfere with their rights as parents and, yes, with their rights as voters. This is wrong. This is dangerous. And I cannot believe that an Attorney General of the United States is engaging in this kind of conduct. And frankly, I can't believe that you are sitting here today defending it.
Anita, what else are we hearing out of Congress about harassment and violence against educators and school board members?
Yeah, that was some very harsh words there. And I will say the Department of Justice, you know, sort of pushed back and said, look, it's not about not allowing people to go to the school board meetings or to protest or to speak their mind, which obviously is a part of American life, but it's to get rid of these threats. And so what the Department of Justice is saying more specifically is that in the next month, arrange for state and local leaders to meet with federal officials to talk about how to get rid of these threats. So there's a real disconnect there on what this would do and what this means for around the country. You know, as you just played, Senator Hawley and some other Republican senators really are pushing this point that they and other like-minded people are trying to be silenced around the country. It's really during the pandemic, this has really taken off as an issue. And we see a lot of, actually, my colleagues had a great story the other day showing that this has really become an issue in school board races that used to be, you know, that are often nonpartisan, that used to be, you know, sort of sleepy races. Mm-hmm. But this issue about whether people can speak up about masks, can speak up about critical race theory and other issues has become sort of this major issue in these local races around the country.
How are you thinking about this, though, Jonathan, that these school boards have become a place where these broader political fights are being had? And to be clear, there's a history of this in the U.S. This isn't a new problem, but it just feels particularly acute right now.
Certainly. And it's because of the pandemic and how it has even further shattered and divided our body politic. And school boards aren't the only place where this is happening. Hospitals, doctor's offices, healthcare providers, the same idea where people are harassing nurses or doctors saying, well, why won't you give my ailing loved one the Invectamine, however we say that, the horse, yeah, thank mm-hmm. you. Or other hydroxychloroquine or other unproven treatments, because those have become political issues. That they're, you know, those on the right believe that those are treatments that should be given to people who don't want to take the vaccine. So sadly, hospitals and schools are just another battle line in this deeply divided American politics.
Well, coming up after the break, we'll dig into the latest COVID news. A reminder that you can join future conversations. Just download our 1A Vox Pop app and leave us a voicemail. You're listening to the News Roundup.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BASF. North American Chairman and CEO Michael Hines shares why they're taking on the challenge of improving the batteries in electric cars.
We are one of the major suppliers of the main ingredients that you would find in a car manufacturer's battery. And as the automotive industry is shifting more towards electromobility, we also have a responsibility through science to come up with some of these solutions.
To learn more about BASF's battery material innovations, go to BASF.com.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the News Roundup. Let's get back to the conversation. And let's bring in Dan Diamond, a health reporter with the Washington Post. Dan, welcome back.
Jen, thanks for having me back.
So on Tuesday, Johnson & Johnson announced that it has filed for authorization of a booster shot for those 18 and older. How soon could that booster be available?
Well, there's a thought that the booster could be available in the coming weeks. J&J officials applied for the shot. FDA advisors will review the data next week, and J&J is going to present evidence that a booster shot dramatically ramps up the number of antibodies and significantly reduces the risk of a severe infection. And Jen, I think the big picture is that all three U.S. vaccine manufacturers, J&J, Pfizer, and Moderna, are now saying that extra shots can be important to ward off serious consequences from COVID, there's already the decision that if you got Pfizer, there's a good chance you could get a booster. And there's a chance also that advisors will recommend booster shots for Moderna next week, too.
Now, according to CDC data, the number of booster shots has outpaced the rate of new vaccinations. What does that signal to you?
Well, I think it means that the people who have opted to get vaccinated are very conscious of the risks of COVID. They're approaching the pandemic in a different way than people who remain holdouts. Those folks are more dug in. There, unfortunately, is a political split here. Democrats are significantly more likely than Republicans to have been vaccinated. And I think we just see a doubling down in that behavior, which is depressing. We know at this point, even though the news has been pretty bleak, cases are still pretty high, there remains evidence that vaccinations continue to protect people from the worst effects of the virus. So the vaccine remains an important tool to get out of the pandemic.
Well, the CDC issued guidance this week ahead of the holidays about how to celebrate safely. But later, the agency said that guidance was released in error. What was the error?
Well, Jen, this has happened a few times where CDC or another government agency will put up guidance that maybe didn't get signed off by everyone. And I did quickly look at the guidance before it got pulled down. The agency was encouraging people to hold virtual gatherings if possible for the holidays, or if you're meeting up in person, rely on fresh air, by which I mean opening windows or meeting outside, not listening to Terry Gross, although I happen to think that that's a good recommendation too. But I think CDC may have pulled these recommendations down for a few reasons. One, they were similar to guidance from last year, very similar, almost word for word, which was a little surprising. The pandemic continues to be at a serious point, but we also have more than half the country fully vaccinated. We should be able to approach the holidays this year very differently than last year. And then there's the second issue of officials worrying about sending the wrong message one way or another. Dr. Fauci was asked this week about holiday gatherings. He said on Face the Nation that it was, quote, too soon to tell about Christmas. He quickly walked that back, said he was going to have Christmas in person. But federal officials, they don't want to unnecessarily scare people, but they also know it's hard to make predictions for a few months away when you're dealing with an evolving virus.
So is the expectation that new guidance will be released?
New guidance should be coming. That's what CDC has said. I also think new tools will be coming, Jen. One thing that would be really helpful is having access to rapid testing. So if you're getting together with relatives, you have a better sense. Has anyone who just stepped off a plane, is that person infected and possibly putting other people at risk? Those rapid tests have been really hard to find in recent months. The Biden administration this week announced a $1 billion plan to make rapid tests more widely available, which outside experts have said it's a good move, though overdue.
Well, let's move to the West Coast, where the city of Los Angeles approved one of the strictest vaccine mandates in the country on Thursday. It requires anyone who is entering bars, restaurants, sporting events, and other indoor spaces to provide proof of full vaccination. That's set to take effect November 4th. Dan, what's the response been to this move?
Well, I think there is the traditional split of folks who want as much protection as possible. And in L.A., about 70% of people in the broader county over the age of 12 are fully vaccinated. So lots of people do support the idea of more protection. But then there are businesses, which now have the onus put on them to enforce the rules, that are asking, I think, legitimate questions. The restaurants that might face a series of fines every time they're found to have admitted an unvaccinated person. So what should they do, they're saying? Do we need to have a bouncer at every door? Do we need to make sure that there is some sort of technology in place for people to easily present their vaccination card? There have been a few other big cities, New York, San Francisco, that have imposed similar rules too, and local leaders are looking for whatever tool they can find to blunt potential surges in virus. I will say, Jen, there are some unusual breakdowns in how these rules are being applied. In Los Angeles, there is the Staples Center. It's the arena where the Los Angeles Lakers and other teams play. The Staples Center said on Thursday it's going to follow Los Angeles county rules, not city rules. The county rules are a little different. They're not as strict. Under those rules, people who go to the Staples Center don't have to be vaccinated. They can just show a negative COVID test. And I think this speaks to the patchwork nature of these regulations. I've walked around Staples Center. It's in downtown LA. I remember getting lunch across the street from Staples Center a few years ago. The risk of transmission of COVID doesn't go dramatically up and down if you're sitting on the one side of the street or if you're in Staples Center. But we as human beings keep interpreting these mandates based on things like city and county lines that the virus doesn't pay any attention to.
Well, before we let you go, this week the Washington Post secured documents that revealed how much money was spent on chartered flights for the former Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price. What did you find?
This story builds on an investigation we did 4 years ago at Politico, along with my colleague Rachna Pradhan. There were a series of stories about how Tom Price, Trump's health secretary, was flying around the country in charter jets, the cost of hundreds of thousands of dollars to taxpayers, flying to the Aspen Ideas Festival, flying from Washington Dulles to Philadelphia. And 10 days after our first story, Price resigned. Now, as our stories were publishing, Carol Lenig, who's done great Washington Post investigations into the Secret Service and Donald Trump, she had the foresight to file for a request for internal documents about Price's trips. And a few weeks ago, the government finally dropped off hundreds of pages of emails, memos, other documents. So Carol and I poured through them. We found health officials strategizing about how to fly these trips, making the decision that even though career officials were at times raising questions about the cost, that they would go ahead anyway. One official described a $15,000 charter flight between Dulles and Philadelphia. He was trying to make the case that they should book it. He said it was a steal. I don't know about you, Jen. I've done that trip on Amtrak. It's about $200 round trip, less if you drive. But I will say on a personal note, it felt sort of quaint to revisit this travel scandal 4 years later. At the time, it felt like the biggest story I'd ever work on. But after the past 2 years, coming on your program to talk about it at times, Trump officials trying to change CDC reports or President Trump ordering officials to find hydroxychloroquine, like Jonathan mentioned earlier, it felt more like a warm-up for the healthcare sagas we've seen recently.
So any other health news you're following in the weeks ahead?
I think the continued push on vaccine mandates is interesting. President Biden gave a speech this week, really stumping for it. His administration, though, has yet to release actual rules that would compel a lot of businesses to get in line. So we may see more of that. And then the global issue remains really important. I think we forget about it here. We are understandably focused on what's in front of us. But people around the world continue to lack access to vaccine. That means that they're at higher risk of the virus. And they don't always have a voice in the U.S. media. So I know that that's something I'm continuing to pay attention to as well.
That's Dan Diamond. He's a health reporter with The Washington Post. Dan, such a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Jen.
On Wednesday, the Department of Education released its plan to overhaul a program that was intended to forgive student debt for those who devote their careers to helping others. It's called Public Service Loan Forgiveness. But the program has been hard to take advantage of. Back in 2018, when the first round of eligible people applied, 99% of them were denied. Anita, why has public service loan forgiveness been so unforgiving?
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are incredible here. So this is something that was created back in 2007 by Congress, and it pertains to certain people. So these are people that have certain government jobs and work for nonprofits, teachers, people like that. Basically, there were limits on what could it's kind of complicated, but basically some of these payments that they were making weren't counted towards this loan forgiveness. So what we found is that the education department had said they couldn't give credit for certain payments that they didn't lack the authority, that they lacked the authority to do so, but now they can do it. So what that means is certain people were giving payments they thought were eligible for this process. You had to have 10 years of loan loans, and then you could be forgiven for these others. And what they found out and they didn't know is that these payments that they'd been making didn't count towards this program.
So to be clear, they could have 10 years of loan payments and then the rest could be forgiven?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And so what they found was these payments they were making weren't eligible, and they had no idea. So what you're seeing from around the country is people making years of payments, big payments, $500, $600 a month, and they weren't eligible for this program. It didn't count towards this program. And the Department of Education knew this issue, but they said that they never had the authority to fix it. And what they're saying now is that they can do it. So they are doing a lot of different things. They are offering temporary waivers to count some of those payments that had been deemed ineligible. That had tripped up a lot of different people. They also are dealing separately with certain federal employees and military service members. All of this will affect, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. I will add that the Biden administration, the president himself, has been pushed for months since the day he came into office and even before to really tackle this issue. And while this goes to a certain point, it's not nearly as far as some of the people in his party want him to go.
I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. Jonathan, what are some other folks in the Democratic Party calling for around loan forgiveness?
Well, forgiving student debt was a rallying cry for a number of the more progressive candidates who ran for president in 2020, or if not entirely, all of it for everyone, certainly more than this program. But it's one that Biden as a candidate, now president, has been relatively consistent on. He's not going as far as, say, Bernie Sanders on this. So there is, you know, a move here to expand it some. There's talk of those who have disabilities to also have loan forgiveness to make that easier. But I don't think we're approaching, at least not anytime soon, you know, full forgiveness.
Well, let's head to the soccer field. On Wednesday night, 6 minutes into the National Women's Soccer League game between Gotham and Washington Spirit, gameplay paused.
Every player from both teams in the middle of the field. I think you can see, you can feel the weight of this statement, this moment for the players.
During every game Wednesday night, NWSL players linked arms in a circle. The protest was in response to weeks of reports of alleged abuse within teams and around the league. The crowd reacted with a standing ovation. The reports of alleged abuse are not limited to one team. Anita, can you give us a rundown of what's happening across the league?
Yeah, it seems like every day there's a little bit new information on this. What we're finding and what we saw this week is that there were more allegations, and these are the newer allegations are abuse of sexual misconduct. There were also allegations of verbal abuse for quite some time. And we've seen three coaches fired this year, including coach from the North Carolina Courage, which is the coach that was accused of that sexual misconduct. And what the league is being accused of is what we've seen in other sports is that they knew about some of these allegations, but they didn't do anything. And what we saw was that the commissioner has now left. So I think we're going to continue to see other people come out, talk about some of these allegations, and the league announced that it's hired someone, actually the former former Attorney General Sally Yates, to conduct sort of an independent investigation on what happened and who knew what when. I think we're going to continue to see sort of fallout from this come out in drips and drabs.
Well, the protest Wednesday also came with a list of demands from players. Jonathan, what are they asking for?
I mean, they're asking for certainly more review. They're asking for more safeguards. They're asking for more protections as to what happened. And this is, I mean, this has been an issue that it's so sad, and it's not obviously limited to soccer either. We certainly had a number of universities, the U.S. women's gymnastics team, have all had similar experiences. And I think it would come long overdue into the spotlight. And I suspect we'll have congressional hearings as well.
Where does this story go from here, Anita?
Well, I think it's like we have seen in other universities, and as Jonathan just mentioned, the gymnastics, which we've been seeing a lot about, whereas we're going to continue to see allegations. And I suspect that we're not, you know, three coaches have been fired already. We don't know what some of those other allegations are going to be. And I think that once you see one player come out and talk, sometimes you see more. And so, you know, there's strength in numbers. And I think that we're going to continue to see that. One thing, though, that I've really been hearing a lot about and reading a lot about is that one of the reasons that players and other supporters have said that there have been so many issues there is that the coaching and the ownership really still are a lot of men. And so there's going to be this great push to get more women in those coaching ranks, but as well as ownership. And I think that's going to be sort of a long-term goal, but you're going to see people really try to push that.
That's Anita Kumar. She's the senior editor of Standards and Ethics at Politico. Also with us, Jonathan Lemire, AP's White House reporter and a political analyst with MSNBC. Anita, Jonathan, thanks for joining us. 1A's audio engineer and sound designer is Mike Kidd. He gets technical assistance from Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Chris Castano is our digital editor. You're listening to the News Roundup. We'll discuss the week's biggest headlines from around the world in just a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
We're rounding up the week's biggest headlines from around the globe. It's the international edition of the News Roundup. You're listening to the 1A podcast. And this is one of two winners of this year's Nobel Peace Prize.
I feel like Alice in Wonderland, and I'm down in a rabbit hole. I'm going out, and I'm going to walk out. This verdict that happened on cyber libel cements it now, right? That 2016, journalists are criminals. In 2020, after the weaponization of social media, the weaponization of the law, now I'm convicted. That's the death of a thousand cuts of our democracy.
We'll talk much more about Maria Ressa and Dmitry Muratov and the reasons why the Nobel Committee chose both of them for this year's Peace Prize. Also important news from Taiwan and France, plus a huge file of documents that we now know as the Pandora Papers. Our guests today are Dave Lawler, World News Editor for Axios. Dave, great to have you back.
Great to be with you.
Jennifer Williams, the Deputy Editor at Foreign Policy. Jen, thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure.
And David Rennie, the Beijing Bureau Chief for The Economist. David, hi.
Hello.
Let's start with a big and important health story. This week, the World Health Organization approved a groundbreaking vaccine for malaria. It could save the lives of tens of thousands of children each year.
We still have a very long road to travel, but this is a long stride down that road. This vaccine is a gift to the world. But its value will be felt most in Africa because that's where the burden of malaria is greatest.
That was the WHO's Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. He's a biologist from Ethiopia. Now, Jen, malaria kills 500,000 people each year, almost all of them in sub-Saharan Africa. How big of a deal is this vaccine, especially for people living in that region?
It's a really big deal. You know, the vaccine isn't perfect. So this is a vaccine that's made by GlaxoSmithKline. Basically, it boosts a child's immune system to fight the deadliest of the five different malaria pathogens. So this is the one that's actually most prevalent in Africa. So it fights that one. In clinical trials, it had an efficacy of about 50% against severe malaria in the first year. Now, that did drop close to zero by the fourth year. In addition, the trials didn't actually measure the vaccine's impact on death, but it did measure against severe malaria. But here's the thing. As you said, this disease kills so many people every year that even preventing a portion of those deaths will end up saving a tremendous number of lives. And this is the first step. You know, it has been a very long time coming in trying to get a vaccine. It's much more complex than, say, you know, the virus that causes COVID, for instance. Hundreds of for 100 years, people have been working on trying to get an effective vaccine for malaria. So that's why, you know, even this kind of step, again, even though it's not perfect, it's still a huge step forward in the fight against malaria.
And David Rennie, there are some challenges around how the vaccine would potentially be given to children, and there's some difficulty in that. Can you explain?
You have to give four doses. You have to give it to babies when they're 5 months, 6 months, 7 months, and then 18 months old. One of the smart things they did with this pilot scheme, which was done in Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi, was they gave the vaccine with a whole bunch of routine childhood vaccines. Because one of the tragedies of African child public health is there are so many things, preventable things, that kill so many children that if you have a limited amount of time and money and medical personnel, you have to be sure that if you're adding a new malaria vaccine to the mix, that's the best use of their time and that money. And that was one of the question marks. This vaccine has actually been known about, that they had successful clinical trials 6 years ago. So this pilot was enormously important because they gave it to 800,000 infants and they saw what happened to those effective rates. And even as Jen says, this is, you know, only 30-40% effective. that's effective enough and cost-effective enough that it can be added to all the other things you need to do. So this is fantastic news. It's unbelievably hard to get a vaccine that attacks a parasite, which is what malaria is. It's a parasite that comes out of mosquitoes into people's bodies, then gets into their liver and basically destroys their blood cells. Such a difficult parasite to attack that this one actually targets it at one specific moment when it's just entered the bloodstream, but before it gets into your liver. But you also need bed nets, you need pesticides, you need insecticides, you need clear stagnant water, all the kind of hard grinding work of trying to eliminate this thing that kills 500,000 people a year, as you say.
Now, Dave Lawler, this is the first vaccine approved to target a parasitic disease. What does this mean for other parasitic diseases? Is this a breakthrough beyond malaria?
We can hope so. It's kind of like how we have this suite of coronavirus vaccines now, and there's a question of how that will translate to future coronaviruses or similar diseases. But as David mentioned, parasites are much more difficult to attack. That's why it took 100 years to get a malaria vaccine. And part of the question here is we still need this vaccine to be produced at the kind of scale where it can be rolled out to as many sort of children under five in Africa, which is the population that's most affected by this. That there's still many steps before we have this reduction in deaths that we're all hoping will come. And so it's not just the case of what these clinical trials showed us, but also the experience of rolling out these vaccines at scale in the coming years.
So, Jen, what is next? What's the distribution plan?
Well, they're still going to be working that out. But, you know, luckily, if you can say that, the COVID crisis, the COVID pandemic has really helped scale up. You know, it's not still not perfect as well, but it's helped scale up vaccine distribution across the continent of Africa in particular. But we've all seen, you know, we've all learned how quickly, you know, you can actually scale up vaccine distribution plans even here in the U.S. And so, you know, being able to kind of capitalize on those additional plans that are already in place, that infrastructure that's already being built should be able to help. It's also, I think, important noting that this isn't the only malaria vaccine that's out there. Other ones are actually in clinical trials right now. And there's one that just concluded a recent phase two trial. It's called R21/MM, you know, a really catchy name. Mm-hmm. But that one was 77% effective. So that's even, you know, a bigger step up than the one that was just given approval. So, you know, there are a lot of kind of good signs coming for a disease that has really killed just tens of thousands of people and just been utterly devastating, especially in Africa.
Well, it looks like the Gavi Alliance, that's formerly the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, that's this public-private partnership, is going to take the lead. David Rennie, can you tell us more about Gavi?
Yeah, so Gavi, people will have heard that maybe if they've been reading about how COVID gets delivered to poor countries. It's this alliance that basically buys a kind of portfolio of vaccines that it can distribute to the lowest income countries. And one of the big decisions coming is that Gavi is going to have to look at this result of this pilot scheme and work out, with all the other pressures on its time and budgets, is this something that you should add to the mix? There's some other really important things that need to be done alongside these vaccines that I think public health people will be very excited by this attention that we're paying to the vaccine, but they hope we don't forget the simple stuff. One of the simple things is that if you can cure and treat malaria in the first 3 days after it's caught, it's much cheaper and easier to fight. And so just getting cheap, very accurate, quick diagnostic testing kits out into rural areas is an unbelievable advance. Because one of the tragedies of this is malaria is so prevalent that even in areas of sub-Saharan Africa, as you say, where this is overwhelmingly the problem, if you have children sleeping under insecticide-treated bed nets, that isn't that effective. Kids under five in some of these villages will catch malaria six times a year. And even if some of those doses aren't that bad, it can stunt their growth, which then affects their learning ability, that can leave them kind of mentally very, very backwards. And so it is just an absolute tragedy that there's about 10 countries in Africa plus India where 70% of the world's cases take place. So really, if we have an incredibly concentrated effort in the places where this is worst, we could make an enormous, enormous difference.
Well, Dave Lawler, this is coming during the global pandemic and efforts to distribute COVID vaccines. How might those two efforts collide?
Well, as David mentioned previously, it can actually be a benefit if you have vaccination campaigns going simultaneously. Now, this will be slightly different than the COVID rollout because we're targeting really children, babies with this vaccine, and that is not currently the case with the COVID vaccine. But there are already pretty robust vaccination campaigns in many of the countries that are badly affected by malaria, childhood vaccination campaigns. And so they won't be starting from scratch here. But yes, in terms of where the funding goes and where the production capacity is, that could be a strain on this particular vaccine because we are talking about hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of doses that will have to be produced of this vaccine. We know the challenges that exist with the COVID vaccine as well. So there can be benefits. I mean, certainly you wouldn't call it a benefit to have a pandemic going on, but to have multiple vaccination streams going at once can help the efficiency. But also, you know, the pandemic has challenged all sorts of resources, and certainly the supply of vaccines is one of them.
Well, and Jen, just very briefly, what would it mean if we got to a point where we were finally able to eradicate malaria, not just for sub-Saharan Africa, but for the entire globe?
It would be a huge deal. I mean, you know, here in North America, we have mostly eradicated it. The number of cases here are in the, you know, the low hundreds to thousands every year. So if we could get that kind of level in Africa, it would be, you know, the difference of, you know, potentially millions of lives in the long run, which is incredible, just not just for human lives, but for economic development, for, you know, for living, for just moving forward in economic and social development. It would be a huge, huge, huge benefit.
Well, two journalists have been awarded this year's Nobel Peace Prize.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2021 to Maria Ressa and Dmitry Muratov for their efforts to safeguard freedom of expression, which is a precondition for democracy and lasting peace. Ms. Ressa and Mr. Muratov are receiving the Peace Prize for their courageous fight for freedom of expression in the Philippines and in Russia. At the same time, they are representatives of all journalists who stand up for this ideal in a world in which democracy and freedom of the press face increasingly adverse conditions.
Maria Ressa of the Philippines and Dmitry Muratov of Russia. Jen, remind us of some of the stellar reporting that Maria Ressa has done in the Philippines.
Sure. So Maria Ressa, you know, as you said, she's one of the most prominent journalists in the Philippines. She co-founded this investigative news site called The Rappler. You know, some people may actually remember she was one of Time's People of the Year in 2018. She appeared on its cover. She's a Fulbright scholar. But she was convicted last year of cyber libel, and that was over a specific story in 2012 that reported, it was done by one of her reporters as well. It reported on links between the country's then Chief Justice Renato Corona and wealthy businessmen. And so she has done a lot on, you know, really targeting corruption in particular early on. And now more recently, she has much more moved toward disinformation, looking at how social media is used to spread disinformation. But she's a very tough critic of the president, of Rodrigo Duterte, and very much a thorn in his side. Duterte has deployed all sorts of, you know, really harsh measures against journalists. He was labeled as a press freedom predator this year by Reporters Without Borders. He's, you know, filed spurious charges against other journalists, including tax evasion. Ressa has also been previously charged with tax evasion. He also uses the internet. He uses basically an army of trolls, like we've seen from other countries, to harass journalists online. And so when she, you know, does reporting on disinformation, on the use of social media to spread lies and disinformation, that directly goes to some of the strategies used by Duterte. So that's why, you know, she really gets under his skin very directly.
Now, David Rennie, what about Dmitry Muratov's reporting in Russia?
So it's a remarkable thing that in a country where journalists are murdered for their reporting, including, let's not forget, one of the most famous journalists from the newspaper that is edited by Dmitry Muratov, the Novaya Gazeta, He still keeps going. It's an extraordinary thing. So Novaya Gazeta is pretty much the last really independent newspaper in Russia. It tackles the toughest subjects, corruption, unlawful arrest, as the Nobel Prize Committee said, electoral fraud, the presence of Russian forces and hidden disguised Russian forces outside the country. And he has been the editor-in-chief since 1995 of this paper. And Anna Politkovskaya, the journalist who famously was murdered 15 years ago, was one of his reporters. She used to report on what was going on in the Chechen War. So it's an extraordinary thing that this very, very brave man somehow manages to cling on. And he said in his own kind of response to the prize that he felt that it was retribution for Russian, that the prize was a kind of retribution for all Russian journalism, which is being so repressed right now.
Dave, many people thought this year's award might go to someone fighting the coronavirus or climate change. What does it say to you that they chose two journalists?
So obviously, these two people, as the committee itself said, are representatives of the broader effort to continue to do journalism in countries where it is becoming increasingly difficult. The Philippines and Russia are obviously on sort of the extreme end of that, but they're not alone. This is a message not just for these two countries, but more broadly about the importance of doing journalism in difficult circumstances, and perhaps a message to the governments as well in the Philippines and in Russia that have in recent years really stepped up their repression of independent journalism. In both cases, even during the pandemic, there have been new efforts to try to block the kind of journalism that these two outlets were doing. So it's certainly a message in support of journalism. And frankly, I think the committee may have decided to steer away from a politician this time around because they've had some challenging recent history with subsequent events for people who were awarded this prize in recent years.
Well, let's turn to another work of investigative journalism. A trove of financial documents was released this week that showed how the world's richest people really know how to avoid taxes. Nearly 12 million documents were released by media organizations working with the nonprofit International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Jen, what do these so-called Pandora Papers tell us?
They tell us a whole lot. As you said, almost 12 million documents and files, and they reveal the secret wealth and dealings of world leaders, politicians, billionaires, more than a few pop stars, including Shakira and Ringo Starr. It's, you know, 300 public officials, government ministers, judges, mayors, military generals in more than 90 countries. I mean, these are massive financial disclosures here. And it shows a lot of shady dealing. And what's interesting here, though, is it's not necessarily illegal, right? What it shows is a lot of use of offshoring of wealth, of, you know, parking your wealth in fancy real estate, maybe in London or in, you know, shell companies in the Caymans or in Panama. And, you know, basically that way you're able to, one, hide the fact that you have all of this wealth from the prying eyes of your own domestic constituents. And also you can avoid paying a lot of taxes on those properties. And so we've seen this, you know, again, this is just the latest in these kind of big sweeping disclosures we've seen before with the Panama Papers, et cetera. And so it's just kind of another example of just how much money is out there being moved around out of sight and out of mind from so many people.
Dave Lawler, I think what was perhaps surprising to some people is, you know, when we think about offshore accounts, a certain image comes into mind. You think palm trees and beaches, but some of these so-called offshore havens are actually in the U.S. Where does South Dakota come into all of this?
Yeah, so South Dakota, this was new to me. I didn't realize before this reporting came out that South Dakota had kind of become the Cayman Islands with worse weather, I guess. But there are very loose regulations on disclosures and things that are necessary for assets parked in South Dakota. So it has become one of these major places where money that, you know, is coming from overseas, usually in some kind of anonymous shell company. South Dakota is a new place alongside, as Jen mentioned, you know, there was a lot of real estate in London that came up in this. That is not a new problem, but that was another place. You know, there are other, beyond just kind of the Caribbean, there are other
locations that continue to arise when these reports come out. But South Dakota, the increasing prominence of South Dakota was a new one to me.
David Rennie, whose finances did we learn more about?
In some cases, we knew that there were some very rich people who are using these shell companies, we assume, to either buy property anonymously or it's going through tax havens, and you can draw your own conclusions. So, for example, the billionaire populist who's the Prime Minister of the Czech Republic, actually facing election pretty soon, Andrej Babiš, he's one of the people in this in these documents. He's alleged to have transferred $22 million through shell companies to buy some property. He just turned around and went, "It's my money. It came out of a Czech bank. Nothing to see here." He's still ahead in the polls. So the truth is that in some of these cases, rich people who are known to be rich are not going to suffer for it. I think that you're seeing a lot of attention on some of the developing country leaders and their families, you know, in Kenya, in Azerbaijan, who have been using this. But I'd like to say, as a Brit, that the British really should be a bit ashamed of this too, because, as Dave said, a lot of this money goes into nice houses in my hometown, London. One of the reasons for that is not just that there's some very nice houses in London, if you've got the money, but also that the UK government has had draft legislation since 2018 to try and say that property should be ultimately registered under the name of the real owner rather than just some anonymous shell company, but has not yet had parliamentary time to push that through because a lot of very, very rich and powerful people are propping up a lot of money in the UK property market. And London is full of extremely expensively educated, plummy, beautifully tailored lawyers, accountants, and tax experts who can hide your money for you. And that is disgraceful because we are not a developing country. We're supposed to be one of the good guys.
Well, the outrage has been palpable. Here's European Member of Parliament Radek Sikorski, who chairs the EU-US delegation in Brussels.
There is no such thing as offshore anyway. They're all onshore somewhere. This is all a fiction. These are just loopholes exploited by over-clever lawyers. And we can do something about it. We need the money, but we need to restore the moral basis of capitalism, or else.
Dave, is anyone going to get in trouble for this? Like Jen said, a lot of this stuff isn't illegal.
Yeah, so since most of it is not illegal, we're talking about maybe political trouble. There are people like President Zelensky of Ukraine, who was elected on an anti-corruption platform. It turns out that he allegedly had a stake in a shell company that was transferred to one of his friends shortly before he was elected. So the idea is that he may have been trying to hide, you know, not declare that wealth. That's a difficult political situation for him. Imran Khan in Pakistan, he wasn't personally implicated, but multiple members of his cabinet were. And when he was campaigning to become prime minister, he really seized on a previous sort of trove of documents, the Panama Papers, and how members of the elite were implicated there. And the idea was that he was going to come in and clean house. So there are a few people who are facing difficult political situations. But I think you're right that in most cases, this is not something that can, you know, is going to end up in the courts.
Jen, what other reactions are we seeing from governments around the world?
So authorities in a number of countries have actually announced investigations into the new findings, everywhere from Australia, Brazil, the Czech Republic, Mexico, Pakistan, Panama, Spain, Sri Lanka. The thing is, though, you know, as Dave mentioned, you know, you're most likely not going to see a ton of accountability. So the problem is that, again, like I said before, this isn't the first tranche of these documents we've seen. We saw the Panama Papers previously. And after those papers were released a few years ago, there was a kind of similar uproar about, oh my gosh, you know, oh my gosh, all of these rich people are hiding all of this money. And a lot of countries tried to address it. And for the most part, even when they did, the people just moved the money elsewhere and moved it around again and put it in another shell company with another layer with, you know, a different person randomly named as the manager of the account. The problem is that there are so many countries that provide so many different financial services like this, much of them in Western democracies, that it's really hard for one country to, you know, craft legislation that's going to crack down on it when, you know, there are dozens of other countries where you can park that money. And so, you know, we may see here or there some, you know, attempts by legislations and by legislatures to actually try to, you know, tighten some of these. But until the actual countries that are providing these services actually crack down and get better at, you know, regulating the financial services industries, that's not going to change anything.
Well, David Rennie would also require a global commitment to dealing with these issues. A sort of piecemeal approach doesn't make any sense if people can just move their money to another country.
That's right. And you have seen some big advances in the kind of the world of sort of tax avoidance and tax evasion, you know, basically not least because a ton of rich world governments are running short of money and would like to have some more tax revenues. I think you are, you know, so will you stop shady rich people with access to good lawyers hiding money? No, they will always be able to do that. But I think that at the kind of the macro level, you are seeing groups like the G7 or the G20 coming together, the OECD, all these clubs of important rich world governments are coming together. And I think there is much more commitment than there used to be. There was a lot of foot dragging by governments that had their own selfish interests that they were protecting, that they weren't, you know, the British government among them, because it has these overseas territories like the Virgin Islands or the Cayman Islands, where some of these shell companies are run. There is now far more political pressure to try and make sure that people just can't completely avoid paying tax in a kind of grotesque way, because there's a lot of money to be, a lot of governments are very short of money right now because they've been spending money on things like COVID and stimulus payments. And so I think the politics is changing at the governmental level. But I think that the key is that those countries that say that they obey the rules, they really need to stop the kind of shady stuff. And so it's countries like the UK, it's countries like Ireland, it's countries like the US, frankly, where it's not just South Dakota, it's also Delaware has some very murky corporate accounting laws. They need to get serious about cleaning up at home before we start kind of trying to save the whole world.
And Dave Lawler, what kind of conversations has this triggered in the US?
So, I mean, basically, we've had cycles of this before, as has been mentioned. But yeah, I mean, there weren't as many Americans listed in these papers because, frankly, actually, in the U.S., it's easier to put your money somewhere and not pay that much tax on it than it is in other countries. So you might have more necessity to go to offshore accounts if you're living somewhere else in the world. And so, I think that there's a conversation beyond just these offshore accounts that has to be had about taxation. And that is something that the Democrats have seized on. If you are a billionaire in the U.S. and you're already paying so little tax that you don't even feel the need to take out an account in the Cayman Islands, then perhaps that's a different conversation, but part of this same broader issue we're talking about people not paying what many would say is their fair share in taxes.
Jen, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think there are two things, too, on the U.S. side. So, one, this did prompt some members of Congress to make a push for this bill that's called the Enablers Act, that's supposed to be introduced coming soon, maybe even today. It may have been. I have been on the radio. I'm not sure. But this is basically designed to require lawyers and PR firms and accountants to check if they're dealing with dirty money. So there should be hopefully some movement. But again, that's Congress, so no one knows.
We shall see. The first major study in France of sexual abuse of children in the Catholic Church reveals shockingly large estimates of victims. The report estimates that more than 200,000 minors have been abused by clergy members since 1950. That number goes up to more than 300,000 after including others affiliated with the church, like school staff. David, what does this tell us about the global scope of this problem?
It's absolutely extraordinary, this report. This really began, listeners will remember, in 2002 in Boston with the report into the Catholic Archdiocese there. It's then we've had reports in Germany where they found they estimated some like 3,000 children had been abused. Lots and lots of countries, Australia, they've had trials of very senior clergy. This is just another whole scope. This is 100 times as many children as the report found in Germany. This was commissioned under tremendous pressure after some cases of terrible abuse. This was commissioned by the Catholic Bishops' Conference itself. It's taken 2 years. It's involved lawyers and medical experts, very, very large numbers of witnesses. And it's just extraordinary. The leader of the survey, Jean-Marc Sauvé, he said that it is uncovered. The Catholic Church's reaction was to protect itself as an institution, and that it showed complete, even cruel indifference to those who suffered. And I have to say, just very briefly, I remember I was a journalist in America in 2002 when this very first broke, and I found myself in Boston in a top law firm who had been acting for one of these victims of abuse. Now, without mentioning names, we sat in this kind of very smart office looking out over the whole of Boston, and they showed me the subpoena documents from the Catholic Archdiocese, and it completely changed my view of this, because you could see these priests, in some cases bishops, discussing what was being done to these children with absolute contempt. You know, these children were a nuisance. There was a nun who was making trouble. She had to be told to keep quiet. A priest had been a bit silly. We may have to move him. You could just see these documents from several years ago. There was just an absolutely appalling moral failure at the heart of the church, and it's been rolling around the entire world. And, you know, France now, you've had they've got 12,000 priests now in the Roman Catholic Church in France. That's half the number that it was 20 years ago. And half of those 12,000 are over 75. So it's really a church that is dying. And this is going to be a devastating further blow.
Well, Jen, some survivors of this abuse and advocates say it's unclear how the church would act on the report's recommendations. The number one recommendation is to check the criminal record of any person in the church in contact with children. Another is to make clear that sexual violence against children will be reported to authorities, even if reported in confession. Is there any indication that the church is willing to do take any of this guidance in under consideration?
I think there is, just because, you know, if you remember earlier this year, Pope Francis actually changed the Roman Catholic Church's laws to explicitly criminalize sex abuse. It was one of the biggest overhauls of the Roman Catholic Church's criminal code in nearly 40 years. So I think there is a sense that something actually has to change, that reforms need to be made and made right now. You know, the Pope called this his shame, personal shame, and also our shame, meaning the church. You know, but I think what you really need to think about, too, with this report is that, you know, more than half of these cases were before 1970, which means that a lot of these people, a lot of these cases, you know, a lot of the victims will never actually see justice in terms of actually getting to prosecute the abusers, many of whom are dead. And, you know, statutes of limitations, you know, prevent some of these cases from going to trial. The inquiry did call on the church to take responsibility and provide compensation to the victims, but that alone is not going to be enough. They will actually need to take these reforms. I think the good news, if there is any, is that Pope Francis himself seems to be at least willing to first discuss this, but also to actually make concrete changes that could help prevent this going forward.
Dave, what do you think is next for the church?
So, I mean, obviously, this has been a story which the church feels both is very necessary to come out and say they are ashamed of and they are turning a corner. There's also a certain amount of defensiveness still on some level. And I think it was interesting that this report also looked at other settings like state-run schools and summer camps, because, you know, there is this claim that this is a societal problem. It's not a church problem. And it found that abuse was, the rates were much higher in the church than they were in these other settings. So it really is a church problem. As Jen mentioned, Pope Francis has come out and said he recognizes this and things will change. But, you know, and again, as David mentioned too, this is in the West, this is a church that is in very dire straits. People are not joining the priesthood. You know, membership is going down in churches. And so, yeah, how do you both try to change the narrative to something that's more positive about the church and not just focus on abuse while also making clear to people that you're taking this seriously and things will change? It's a very difficult challenge for the church going forward.
David, your thoughts?
Look, if you're an optimist, one of the things that was clearly utterly tragic for many of the victims who came forward in this latest report was that their own families didn't want to believe them, because back in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, the village priest, the local priest, was such an extraordinarily sort of powerful figure of authority that it was a shame to even listen to a child. And, you know, we shouldn't forget 90% of the victims, who are almost all boys, were between 10 and 13 years old, according to this report. So these are young children whose own families felt unable to listen to them. So maybe if there is one positive thing that comes out of this, we're now in a world with fewer shadows, fewer kind of automatic, sort of less automatic deference. And, you know, it would be a tragedy if the church died. The church does a lot of good. Churches do a lot of good. But this is clearly an institution which, you know, at the very highest levels was covering this up. France, one of the things, you know, like so many countries, they had a cardinal who was convicted, then his conviction was overturned, Cardinal Barbarin of Lyon. But he had been, he knew that there was a priest who had confessed to abusing dozens of boys. And he covered that up. And so I think until that generation of top church leaders is cleared out, and until you have more transparency and daylight, then you can try to rebuild the church from the ground up.
Jen, I see you nodding along to what David's saying there.
Yeah, I just, you know, I think you have to also just understand the degree of trauma and the lasting trauma that this causes for young children. You know, one of the survivors who was himself abused at the age of 13, he's the head of one of the victims' associations in France. And he told the AP that, you know, he had thought of the priest, of course, as someone who was a good, caring person who would never harm him. And he said, this quote just really has stuck with me. He said, quote, "We keep this. It's like a growing cyst. It's like gangrene inside the victim's body and the victim's psyche." And the inquiry found that 60% or so of the men and women who were abused had gone on to experience major problems in their emotional or sexual lives. So this isn't something that just happens once and then goes away. This is something that an entire generation of men and some women, but mostly men, are still dealing with today. And it has knock-on effects and consequences far beyond just the victims themselves, but for their families, their children, their relationships. And it's just an utter tragedy.
Well, let's pivot back to Asia, because this from Taiwan's foreign minister is worrying a lot of those who've been paying attention to the country's worsening relationship with China.
The defense of Taiwan is in our own hands. And if China is going to launch a war against Taiwan, we will fight to the end. And that is our commitment. And of course, during this period of time, we would like to exchange with other countries for security cooperation. Our security relations with the United States have been improving in order for us to understand the kind of strategy, the kind of preparation we need to do in order for us to be able to successfully defend ourselves.
That's Joseph Wu, part of a TV interview he gave earlier this week to the Australian Press. David, tensions have been simmering for some time, but what's changed lately?
A couple of big things have changed lately. One is that people in the United States, particularly at the top of the military, have been saying in things like congressional hearings for the last year or so that the Chinese military is getting far stronger, could perhaps take Taiwan successfully if they decided to invade Taiwan, and that their behavior suggests that it might no longer be kind of unthinkable. And we saw in March the then head of Pacific Command, General Admiral Davidson, say that he thought it could happen within 6 years. Now, not everyone is that worried. But in the meantime, in addition to that sense that China is getting strong and China is getting impatient, the other thing that is going on is that China believes that America in general is trying to contain and hold China back. China is getting extremely paranoid about things like, you know, routine help that China gives to Taiwan, even things like allies, this new deal with Australia and the UK. When Western warships sail through the Taiwan Straits, China is getting very jumpy. And we've seen them vastly ratcheting up things like these flights that they fly within about 30 miles of the coast of Taiwan. Huge numbers we've seen the last few days, 100 a day in some cases. And there's a real sense that the Chinese are trying to normalize the idea of a very, very sort of aggressive Chinese posture. One of the things that worries people here in Beijing, diplomats here in Beijing, is the Chinese might try and fly a warplane over Taiwan, because the truth is that Taiwan isn't going to shoot down a Chinese mainland warplane. And then, you know, you're really into the business of, is China going to feel confident enough that it could try and take Taiwan? And that basically is a question about, does China believe that America would intervene? Because Taiwan on its own, which is this friendly pro-Western democracy of 24 million people that China claims as part of China, they can't defend themselves without the help of the Americans. And so all of this is about whether the Americans would be willing to spend blood and treasure to save Taiwan if China tried to take them. And that's why there's so much focus at the moment about the US-China relationship. While there's every word that President Joe Biden says is parsed to see if his position is changing. And unfortunately, he's not brilliant at saying his words carefully, and every single syllable counts when it comes to Taiwan. He seemed to have, you know, say he used language that sounded new and novel, which alarmed everyone. Then they had to do some tidy up. But there's just a huge amount of attention about whether America, this America, has the will to defend Taiwan. I think that's why you're seeing Taiwanese leaders coming out so aggressively saying this is a fight between democracy and authoritarian regimes. They're trying to make America focus on their needs.
Well, this issue came up at a White House briefing on Monday. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki had this to say.
We urge Beijing to seize its military, diplomatic, and economic pressure and coercion against Taiwan. And we have an abiding interest in peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait and within the region. We have been clear privately and publicly about our concern about the PRC's pressure and coercion toward Taiwan, and we will continue to watch the situation very closely.
When President Biden told reporters on Tuesday that he had spoken to Chinese President Xi Jinping about Taiwan and they agreed to abide by the, quote, Taiwan Agreement. Dave, what is that agreement?
So there really isn't one, which is why this comment puzzled a lot of people. There is the so-called One China policy, but in terms of Taiwan, the U.S. position is basically that Taiwan's status is undetermined. And so, you know, as David mentioned, even the policy of whether the U.S. would be willing to go to war to defend Taiwan is ambiguous. It's called strategic ambiguity. And so, when this news was cropping up this week, when China was flying all these planes into Taiwan's air defense zone, I was with H.R. McMaster, who you remember was Trump's national security advisor, and I asked him whether the Trump administration had an answer to that question at the time. Were they willing to defend Taiwan militarily? And he basically demurred and made a case for strategic ambiguity. Basically, it encourages Taiwan to strengthen its own defenses while still deterring China from attacking Taiwan. But there's a question of how long that position can hold, really, as this idea of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan that seemed very hypothetical even a few years ago starts to take shape as a real potential threat.
Well, David, briefly, word this week from the Biden administration that the U.S. and China have agreed in principle for their presidents to hold a virtual meeting before year's end. What more do we know at this stage?
Well, they had hoped to do this in person. All sorts of people hoped that President Xi was going to come to various things, not just this summit with Biden, but also the COP climate change summit in Glasgow. President Xi has not left China for, I think it's 629 days now, basically because of COVID. And he is not meeting anyone in person at all. And that's a real problem because the relations between the US and China are so poisonous at the moment that although we had this encouraging meeting with Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, and Yang Jiechi, a member of the Politburo who's kind of his opposite number, they met in Zurich. These are problems so severe that really only the two top leaders can sort them out. And at the moment, unfortunately, the Chinese, who seem to think that they have the whip hand and who also are pretty open in viewing President Biden as a weak transitional figure who might not even be around beyond the next election, they're basically hanging tough and saying, until you do everything that we want, and we have lists of things that you're doing that annoy us, till you work your way down that list and stop provoking us in this way, and this way, whether it's criticizing us on human rights or Xinjiang or Hong Kong or annoying us over Taiwan, we're not even willing to talk. And so the Chinese are currently making it a favor to be willing to talk to America. And that is a very, very serious situation for the two world's most powerful countries.
Well, I want to briefly touch on one more story as we wrap up here. On Tuesday, both Democratic and Republican senators signed a letter to President Biden urging him to expel as many as 300 Russian diplomats from the U.S. They're concerned that Washington is currently home to hundreds more Russian embassy staff than is the case in Moscow. Russia said it would close every American mission on Russian soil if President Biden heeded the call from these 17 lawmakers. Jen, just explain what this is all about.
Yeah, well, a lot of this has to do with what happened with NATO this week. So NATO basically kicked out 8 Russian officials from Moscow's diplomatic mission to NATO, and they halved the number of posts at the mission to 10. They accused them of being spies. We don't actually know what prompted it, but it definitely kicked off a round of U.S.-Russian kind of posturing. Thankfully, that's around diplomats and not weapons, so I'll take it.
Well, thanks to our guest this week, Jen Williams. She's deputy editor at Foreign Policy. David Rennie, again, stayed up very late for us. He's Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. And Dave Lawler, world news editor for Axios. David, Jen, Dave, thanks for speaking with us. 1A's managing producer is Paige Osborne. Mike Kidd is our sound designer and engineer. And Barb Anguiano produces our podcast. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.